Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business. But what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. We're broadcasting today from member station WWNO in New Orleans. Special counsel Robert Mueller, he of the tight lips, broke his 2-year silence on the Russia investigation Wednesday. He announced he'd be closing shop. But first, Mueller took pains to knock down President Trump's claims of, quote, total exoneration from his inquiry.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime.
And last night, President Trump tweeted he intends to impose another new wave of tariffs, this time against Mexico. Trump says he's doing so to force Mexico to halt the flow of migrants into the United States. Vice President Mike Pence made the case for the new tariffs against Mexico from his trip to Canada, where he's promoting revisions in free trade deal.
The president's absolutely determined to use the authorities that he has as president to call on the Congress and to call on Mexico to do more to address this humanitarian crisis at our southern border.
And restrictions on abortion access push forward in states across the country. Here in Louisiana yesterday, Governor John Bel Edwards, a Democrat, signed legislation outlawing abortion as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy. Advocates wearing bright pink T-shirts packed the state capitol in protest. Join us. What did you make of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's statement? What top news story struck you this week? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and Facebooks at On Point Radio. We are broadcasting today, I'm very glad to say, from the studios of our member station WWNO in New Orleans, Louisiana. Our great thanks to them for hosting us and for helping us broadcast this program to you. New just this week, you can also follow us on Instagram. We're live there with the sights and sounds of our trip to New Orleans at On Point NPR. That account, again, is On Point NPR. Give us a follow for more behind-the-scenes looks at what we do. With us here in studio, Jessica Rosegard. She's supervising editor and producer for WWNO, a veteran reporter of politics. She covers it at the local, state, and federal level. Jessica, great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
And great to be here with you, I should say. You're hosting us today. With us also from the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., Julie Mason, host of the Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Julie, delighted you could join us once more.
Hey, Dave.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Julie, and Jessica.
So let's start with today's news, or at least the news of the last 24 hours. The president has indicated through tweets that he intends to ramp up pressure on the Mexican government. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney told reporters in a telephone conference last night that the White House wants to see the number of migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border drop immediately. Mulvaney said the president's willing to use tariffs to get what he wants.
Now we are asking Mexico to do what it can because Congress will not. The president will defend the nation. He will defend the southern border. If that means taking tariffs to 25%, that means taking tariffs to 25%. We hope, sincerely hope, it does not come to that.
Julie Mason, you've covered this president. You've covered a bunch of presidents. Is this a bluff or is the president serious on doing this with such a major trading partner?
Well, maybe it's both, Dave. With Trump, sometimes you never know. It creates a lot of problems for him, though, because first, conflating trade and immigration issues, that's a tough one. At the same time, trying to impose tariffs on Mexico right now, at the same time the president is trying to get this new trade deal, the USMCA, passed, that's a tricky one because the trade deal, as proposed, would limit the U.S. ability to impose these sort of punitive tariffs on Canada and Mexico. So he's at cross-purposes with himself. And But more to the point, this is all about 2020. He wants this immigration fight. He wants to get into this and look tough. This is just a way for him to do that. Whether or not he imposes these tariffs on Mexico is sort of almost beside the point, except for Mexico.
It's very dramatic, Jack Beatty. You know, he's suggesting that it'll be, I guess, increased 5% at first and then increased each month into October to up to, as the acting chief of staff said, up to 25%. As an actual policy, what would that do?
Well, it would be a tax on us, on American consumers and companies. The president persists in the fallacious view that Mexico, like China, would pay the tariff. Not at all. We will. It's a tax. Mr. Trump is the taxingest president we've had in recent years. And so that would be one effect. The other would be the derangement, from what experts say, of what is a complicated latticework of connections between our economies, where primary goods come into our country, they're worked on here, they go back to Mexico, they come back to this country, they go back to Mexico for something else, and then they're sold here. It's almost one economy. And, of course, it'll be fought on the backs of probably our farmers again, who are already facing resistance from Mexico. They did over the steel tariffs against Mexico, and they will probably pay for this as well.
Jessica Rosegard, you know, the Mexican foreign minister has been dispatched to Washington to try to resolve this in what the president of Mexico has said is a non-legal way, presumably not taking him to trade court or some other body to try to mediate this, but work it out between the two nations. You've heard about this interconnectedness that Jack's talked about, that last work. You heard about the political posturing that Julie Mason has highlighted for us. How do such maneuvers on trade and immigration play here in Louisiana?
Yeah, you know, Louisiana has been hit pretty hard by the trade war with China, which is coming up on a full year. You know, there was talk that this wasn't going to be a long trade war. It has been. And farmers here are really feeling the impacts of that. There are over 83,000 jobs in Louisiana that are supported by trade with Mexico, mostly in the petroleum industry. So these things really do have a local impact. And, you know, I thought it was interesting that Julie said Trump is fighting immigration with trade. You know, it seems like a sort of backwards punitive move right there to fight one issue with a different issue entirely.
In some ways, and forgive the pun, but in some ways for, you know, Louisiana these days, it has definitely a Democratic governor, but it's still seen as a pretty red state on the national and presidential level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a sense in which the importance and the symbolism of fighting on immigration, even though Louisiana doesn't physically have a border with Mexico, does that trump concerns about trade and the bottom line in the pocketbook? Or actually are people sorting these things in a very kind of clinical way as they think about it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Louisiana did overwhelmingly support Donald Trump in the election, and lawmakers here continue to support him throughout these trade wars. You know, like I said, particularly with China, the tone that I get from local lawmakers has very much been, we need to wait this out, and we are sticking with the president, and people will suffer in the short term, but in the long term, this is the right move. So I haven't gotten any response from anyone yet specifically on the Mexico issue, but it seems that they are in lockstep with the president here.
You know, it's interesting. This comes within 24 hours of or almost within 24 hours of what happened on Wednesday. I want to play a clip of the outgoing special counsel, Robert Mueller. He has not wanted to speak publicly. He's done this Greta Garbo thing, right, for these many weeks and months. But he came forward Wednesday. He says he doesn't want to speak before the public, and he especially does not want to speak before Congress.
There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony.
Julie Mason, Robert Mueller obviously did hew pretty much directly, almost quite literally, to what he and his team put out in that report. What was the relevance, the importance, the salience of him actually appearing before the public visibly and speaking what he found and did not find about the president out loud?
Well, it was quite profound that he would do that. And he seems to have this ongoing conflict with the attorney general over the scope of his responsibilities. We saw the attorney general come out pretty soon after and say, oh, he could have made a finding. I mean, that was my opinion. But putting that aside for the minute, I think that Robert Mueller would like people to read the report. I think many in Congress especially have not taken the time to do so. But he also set up a really tough situation for Democrats. And because Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, really had thought that she had her party in line on this. She had like the meeting and quieted the loudest voices who were pushing for impeachment, the real sort of activist voices in the party, and she'd got them in line, and they were pretty much unified. And then here comes Mueller saying, "Over to you, Congress. You know, here's all the information. Next up for you." And now they're fracturing. Now they're all over the place. They don't know what to do. They're thinking of a half measure, like open an impeachment inquiry, but not necessarily towards impeachment. And they're trying to figure out a way to make it a political winner for them. But the problem is that, one, it's just going to take up all the oxygen here in Washington, and it could really hurt Democrats running for president. So these are some of the calculations they're thinking of, even though there are some also compelling voices in the party right now saying, look, if we open an impeachment inquiry, we'll be able to get his taxes, what the courts are going to side with us on getting documents that we want and getting the testimony from the people we want to hear from. And that's going to help us in towards an inquiry, towards undermining this presidency, and that will help us politically. But this debate continues, and Democrats don't really see the clear path forward. There are no easy choices right now.
Julie, before we end this first segment, I want to drill down a little bit. How directly do you interpret it that Mueller was saying this is really an issue for the Congress to take up?
Oh, 100%. I'm not even sure there's a debate about that. He felt like there was nothing further he could do. Here is all the work. He's a scholar of the Constitution. He knows which way things go. Interestingly, President Trump said that he doesn't believe the courts would allow an impeachment inquiry to go forward, showing that the president still seems unclear on this process. Congress is the only other body that can take this matter up right now. Mueller was saying, my work is done and I'm stepping back from this office, and now it's up to Congress.
So we're talking about the week in the news from member station WWNO New Orleans. We'll be talking a little bit more about that question hovering like a giant storm cloud over Washington, D.C., the question of impeachment, the I word. You can join our conversation on that. Also, what new laws on abortion are you seeing in your state? How would those laws affect your community? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're diving into the week's top stories from the studios of member station WWNO here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And our new behind-the-scenes Instagram feed that's titled On Point NPR. I'm speaking with Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Jessica Rosegard, she's supervising editor and producer here for WWNO, the NPR member station in New Orleans. And, of course, our own Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Welcome back, one and all. I've got a call now from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, about the inquiry, the Mueller's report. Bart's on. You're on the air. Tell us what you're thinking.
Well, you know, I think it's just a little irritating that the special counsel has stood up in front of the American people and has come out and said that the president has not committed a crime, a very tongue-in-cheek way of saying that he believes that the president has committed a crime, but because his hands are tied constitutionally and it's up to Congress to pursue this, not the Justice Department, he's no longer going to speak on this. I mean, he's opened this Pandora's box and is probably, of people alive, someone who has testified in front of Congress more than anybody else ever has and is uniquely positioned to do so, and yet is saying outright that it is now Congress's job to move forward with this, but he won't say what crimes were committed, and he won't even talk further other than the vague references that he made in the report.
Bart, before I let you off the air, so you want him to march his freshly pressed white crisp Oxford shirt up Pennsylvania Avenue and get himself in front of the House Judiciary Committee. Is that right?
Well, it's not even necessarily that, because I could see how that could be construed into political theater. I think he just needs to clear up some of the things that he has said yesterday on Wednesday with his vague statement. If I were Congress, I would want to call him forward and say, I need you to specifically tell us what crime you think he committed and why, so that we can move forward with this other than just the vague mention of it. Because now it's going to be very easy for the Trump side of the aisle to say, hey, this is still a political witch hunt. Mueller didn't actually say he committed a crime, and you have no proof of it, and this is a closed argument. Why are we still continuing this fight? So the special counsel's actions, while I can understand why he wants to pull himself out of this craziness that's going on the Hill, he has really given a gift to the Trump administration, because he has refused to flat out say, yes, the president committed a crime, and this is the crime that I believe. And I'm fairly confident that what he was alluding to was the obstruction of justice during the investigation.
Okay, Bart. Well, thank you for that. A vote from Oklahoma City for the referee to make a darn call already, even though the referee seems to have left the field. Jack Beatty, I want to play a clip here of the president and then one of the House Speaker, and then I have a question for you. So while leaving the White House yesterday, here's what President Trump forcefully had to say in rejecting calls for his impeachment.
I don't see how they can, because they're possibly allowed, although I can't imagine the courts allowing it. I've never gone into it. I never thought that would even be possible to be using that word. To me, it's a dirty word, the word impeach. It's a dirty, filthy, disgusting word.
Now, as Julie Mason has noted, the courts don't actually get to determine whether Congress takes this up or not. This is what is within Congress's powers constitutionally. Obviously, the person on the spot, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on Wednesday, she vowed to continue congressional investigations into the president. On the question of impeachment, Pelosi proved elusive once more.
Where they will lead us, we shall see. Nothing is off the table. But we do want to make such a compelling case, such an ironclad case, that even the Republican Senate, which at the time seems to be not an objective jury, will be convinced of the path that we have to take as a country.
So, Jack Beatty, help tease out once more a little bit the exquisite dilemma that Nancy Pelosi finds herself in.
It's hard to think of a tougher political choice in recent years that any president or political leader has had to make. Consider the options. On the one hand, if she goes ahead and tries to impeach, the White House has made clear they will use that as an issue to try to flip the House. In 2018, the 41 seats flipped to the Democrats from the Republicans. These were seats in rural Washington State, Utah, South Carolina, Georgia, Pennsylvania, 4 seats, Iowa, 2, Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas, Florida, 2. All of these are states, except for Washington State, that Mr. Trump carried. These were districts he carried. And the chances of, the issue was right there. You overreached, and we're going to use this to take back the House. It's a very risky. It's putting these flipped seats in jeopardy. And then, of course, at the end of it, the Senate will say, "No, we don't convict him." And Mr. Trump will say to the public, "I won. I'm clear.
reelect me. On the other hand, if she does nothing, if they don't try to impeach and say the president wins the election, he's going to take, he will have won the election knowing, or at least, you know, 1,000 former prosecutors of the Justice Department say he has committed multiple felonies in obstructing justice. The president will know that he did all this and he was reelected. Therefore, whatever he wants to do, he might feel willing to do and break down the further the guardrails of democracy. But if, on the other hand, he loses the election, well, does this prosecution by the Democrats sort of inflame his willingness, he's on the record, to try to make a ruckus about the 2020 election and perhaps even a crisis of the Republic? It is a very, very dangerous moment for the Republic, for the country, but then more particularly for Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats.
Dave, if
Jessica
I might
Roskar,
build on that.
Oh,
brief,
sorry.
Briefly.
Sure, Julie Mason, go right ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, a couple right. points that I want to make to, just to add to what Jack said. Polls have shown strong, repeated polls, many polls have shown strong majorities of Americans do not want impeachment. They think that this issue should be decided at the ballot box in 2020. And also, when you think back to Benghazi, right, and how many investigations there were, and how at the end, even with Trey Gowdy's, like, the big finale, it was an unsatisfactory conclusion for both sides. Americans want decisive outcomes. And Congress is not always going to get decisive outcomes. And Nancy Pelosi is very aware that an impeachment proceeding by Congress could end in an unsatisfying conclusion, which would be a real political problem, mostly for Democrats.
Jessica Roskard, obviously you've heard what the polls currently show. Those positions could change if things came to light or mm-hmm. particularly dramatic, but things may not be dramatic, as Julie Mason just points out, rightly so. How is this playing among Democrats here in this red state? You know, a red state like this typically tends to have more moderate strain of the Democratic candidate and figure in Congress, except perhaps in certain tailored congressional seats. How is this playing among Democrats? What do they seem to want to see it play out in the nation's capital?
You know, I think our sole Democrat in Congress, Representative Richmond, he's been kind of, mild-mannered on the whole issue. I mean, I think ultimately what everybody's saying is right, that if it's very risky for Democrats. And, you know, I was thinking about this. If President Trump survives an impeachment, it's basically the equivalent of what he said about he could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and get away with it. That's sort of the political and congressional or parliamentary equivalent of what he said he could get away with all along. And I think it would be really hard if that came to light, like Jack said, and he wins re-election. He's got, you know, carte blanche to do basically whatever he wants at that point.
I just in closing out this part of the conversation, I wanted to note remarks by the U.S. Attorney General, in which he basically said in an interview that aired on CBS Morning. First, he said that he thought Mueller could have reached a conclusion and let us know, which is a nice thing to do after the fact. But he also faced a question on whether he believes the Obama administration officials who initiated and oversaw the Russia investigation committed treason, a claim publicly made by President Trump. Barr was interviewed by CBS chief legal correspondent Jan Crawford.
You don't think that they've committed treason?
Not as a legal matter, right?
But you have concerns about how they conducted the investigation?
Yes, but, you know, sometimes people can convince themselves that what they're doing is in the higher interest, the better good. They don't realize that what they're doing is really antithetical to the democratic system we have.
And Barr himself has, in fact, instigated a formal investigation of the initiation of the investigation of the president, despite the fact that's also already being reviewed by another U.S. attorney and by, I believe, the Inspector General of the Justice Department. I want to turn now to some of the president's adventures abroad and a sort of amazing headline that encapsulates a couple of different episodes involving the president. One of them from The New York Times: "Let's not upset the president. The White House tells the Navy to hide the USS McCain." Julie Mason, what happened here?
This was incredible. This was just staffing gone horribly awry. The president has said, and, you know, I talked to Maggie Haberman from The New York Times about this. She is persuaded that the president did not know that this was happening. But the staff went ahead and asked the Navy, please, could you cover up any mention of the USS McCain that's stationed there in Japan, where the president was visiting the USS Wasp. And so there were some efforts apparently were made with some tarp and things, and the sailors on board the USS John McCain were not invited to the Trump event in Japan, and then it became news and it became a problem. And the point that Maggie made, which I think is an important one, is that we can sort of chuckle about this incident and the pettiness of it, but she pointed out that there's a larger issue, which is the construction of an alternate reality to please the president. And she said that that it's important that we understand that it was bad staffing, and also that we don't really have to go along with it. You know, it's important to point out that reality exists beyond what is constructed to please the president. And just the idea of covering this up, you know, was just so distasteful to so many people. And certainly the acting Pentagon chief, Mr. Shanahan, Patrick Shanahan, was saying that he didn't know about it. He's making inquiries and everything. But it was such an unfortunate event overseas. And especially this was a ship named for John McCain, the senator, his father and his grandfather. It's named for all three of them. So it was not just a John McCain thing. Trump then went on to say that he agreed with the move. He didn't want to have to see that name on a ship while he was over there, which, you know, he thinks that's an issue that works for him. But I think for many people, it's just it's very distasteful. And it's not compatible with his stated ideas or his stated positions that he's very much for the troops and very much interested in the sort of nobility of the U.S. military.
Worth noting that ship also initially named for the late senator's father and grandfather, both of whom were admirals and had, you know, named after them for their naval accomplishments and stature there. Jack Beatty, what does it say to us about the president that he says basically they may have made a mistake, but these were people of good intention in trying to keep that shielded from him, shielded from public view, shielded from proximity to him, given the way in which McCain was at times a thorn in his side in the Republican Party?
Well, it's an instance of planetary pettiness, isn't it? I mean, just going to Japan and doing this, and the behavior of the White House staff vindicates James Comey's comment that, quote, proximity to Trump eats the soul. They're willing to arrange this kind of Potemkin ship so that the president will not be triggered. And what a delicate ego that it can't face the name McCain. I think Meghan McCain, late senator's daughter, made the right call. She said, Trump is a child who will always be deeply threatened by the greatness of my dad's incredible life.
Obviously, the president himself and many of his supporters took affront at the way in which McCain at times separated himself from the president on politics and on policy. I want to turn now to an issue that is roiling a number of states throughout the union right now, and that's the question of abortion. A new law, legislation just passed here in the state of Louisiana, just signed by Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards. Here we have a clip from Louisiana State Senator John Milkovich, who's a Democrat himself, and he sponsored a new law barring abortions as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. At a press conference Wednesday, he said Louisiana is joining state houses across the country in opposition to abortion.
The abortion industry has taken its war against our children to our very doorstep, and we have determined to take the fight to the abortion cartel through the law and prayer to stop the horrific infanticide which is being inflicted upon our children.
There are state laws in Kentucky, Missouri, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, North Dakota that seems to nibble at or in a sense contravene what seemed to be established law in Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court. Jessica Rosegard, tell us a little bit about what's happening in these states, what's happening in your state, and what's at play here.
Yeah, so we've seen, you know, a number of these bills pop up in various states. And so far, it seems that states have really tried to go after the access to abortion by restricting providers, you know, requiring a waiting period and that sort of thing. Louisiana has a bill that's pending the Supreme Court, actually, that would limit abortion providers to have, they'd have to have admitting privileges in a nearby hospital. So that's really gone after the providers. These bills we see are going after the patients, essentially, the women who are seeking these services. And the six-week abortion ban, Louisiana's law is tied to a similar bill in Mississippi. There's actually language in the bill that Louisiana's bill will not go into effect unless the Mississippi bill is upheld by courts. It's currently, it was challenged a week ago. I'm sorry, a judge ruled a week ago to overrule that law, and it's pending now in the Fifth Circuit here in Louisiana. That same judge actually also overruled a law that would ban abortions at 15 weeks, which Louisiana also has that law that is also tied to the Mississippi law. So there's really a lot of sort of interactivity between these bills in these states and the legal challenges. They are all kind of tied together.
It's, you know, here in Louisiana, you have the distinction. We have only a little time left before the break, but the distinction of having Democrats being taking strong public anti-abortion stances. Nonetheless, you have a lot of opinion. 58% of Americans say abortion should be legal in all or most cases, according to just a, you know, 6-7 month old survey done by Pew. 36% of Republicans say abortion should be legal in all or most. 76% of Democrats. Are the people of Louisiana, a state like this, where the legislature and the governor are on this?
I think it's interesting. You know, you have to kind of separate the people of Louisiana into, you know, the people in the cities and the people in the rural areas. Here in New Orleans, you know, a lot of what I've heard is people are really opposed to what this governor has done, despite the fact that he's a Democrat. He's a conservative Democrat. And that's what we have here.
But outside the cities, you might see a very different effect taking place.
Mm-hmm.
We're discussing this week's top news from member station WWNO in New Orleans, Louisiana. We have with us Jessica Rosegard, experienced political reporter for the station, and Julie Mason of SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Coming up, we'll look at Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's statement on the Supreme Court and the devastating weather sweeping across the U.S. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
With Kizik hands-free shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy-on, easy-off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're broadcasting our news roundup from WWNO in New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm speaking with Julie Mason. She's host of The Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Jessica Rosegard, she's supervising editor and producer for WWNO and a veteran political reporter that's here at the NPR member station in New Orleans. And Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. I want to take a quick call first from Akron, Ohio. Holly, you're calling on the air. Tell us your thoughts.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a 53-year-old mother of 5 children, including a beautiful daughter with Down syndrome. I'm also the family columnist for the Akron Beacon Journal, and I work very hard on trying to get accurate information out on the reality of what it means to have a Down syndrome diagnosis in this day and age. These anti-abortion bills, which we passed one here in Ohio, which say that you cannot have an abortion with a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome, are not only cynical use of children like my own chip away at reproductive rights, while we have had a Republican legislature for over 20 years that has routinely cut funding to this population. It is, I just lost my thought because I'm on air. But
well, you know, that I had to make the transition from print to radio, too. Go ahead, Holly. Finish your thought.
Well, and I participated with an amicus brief I'm outraged because this has sucked all the energy away from the pro-information movement that might convince women that having a child with Down syndrome isn't such a bad idea. And in fact, there is some evidence that if these bans were to go into effect, which of course they're unconstitutional, that it would perhaps even increase the termination rate. And when you look at the states that are passing these heartbeat bills, which again, Ohio just did, it is also in states where they routinely are not supporting the children who most need support if they are going to be born, if abortion is criminalized. We also know for a fact that criminalizing abortion does not stop it. In fact, it doesn't even decrease it. And while nobody looks at their beautiful children, their beautiful daughters, and says, I can't wait till she has her first abortion, I think we could all come together and find out why women are having abortions and see if we can solve those problems, including, free and available contraception. So okay. I really appreciate your talking about this today.
I appreciate your perspective, Holly. Before we move on, and the question of judicial nominations is relevant here, before we move on, Jessica Rosgaard, tell us about the position of John Bel Edwards, a largely popular Democratic governor in a very red state, who staked out before he ran for office. Mm-hmm. He let people know he is, against abortion rights, mm-hmm. and seems to be delivering on that promise.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, he is a conservative Democrat. A liberal Democrat would not win election in this state. But the bill that Governor Edwards signed into law, the 6-week abortion ban, is more restrictive than what a lot of Republican leaders are saying at the national level. Amendments failed to provide exceptions for rape and incest. And that is something that the president and Mitch McConnell and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy have all said that they support those exceptions. So it's really interesting to me that this conservative Democrat has supported a bill that takes a position that is even farther conservative than some Republican leaders in the country.
Sometimes positions dictated by where you are on the map rather than the D or the R after your name. In other news this week, Israeli voters will be heading back to the polls. Recently reelected Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu missed his deadline to form a government, marking the first time a new parliament has voted to dissolve itself. An embattled R&B singer, R. Kelly, has been charged with 11 new counts of sexual assault and abuse that could carry a prison sentence up to 30 years if convicted. The alleged victim in this indictment is one of four women he was already accused of abusing back in charges filed in February. And last, a deadly traffic jam atop Mount Everest. At least 11 hikers have died this year attempting to make it to the world's highest mountain peak. Nepal is now considering a rule change on who is allowed to climb the summit. I wanted to talk a little bit about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in Congress. He told reporters at a luncheon in his home state of Kentucky he would fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court if a seat opened up during the 2020 election campaign. He then took the moment to remark on the lasting impact of Supreme Court confirmations.
What can't be undone is a lifetime appointment to a young man or woman who believes in the quaint notion that the job of judges would follow the law. But that's the most important thing we've done with the country, which cannot be undone.
Now, Jack Beatty, obviously the Supreme Court is likely to look at, among other things, questions of new very restrictive abortion laws that seem to conflict with the precedent of Roe v. Wade, questions of the census and others. It was not so long ago that we heard that that Mitch McConnell said one does not consider a nomination in a presidential election year. And yet here he is saying he'd consider one from President Trump when it comes up, if it comes up in 2020.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that gives hypocrisy a bad name. In 2017, he did. He held up. In 2016, he held up Merrick Garland's nomination to the court. He said then the American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court justice. Asked in Paducah this week if he would abandon that stand if a vacancy should occur in 2020, he said, "Oh, we'd fill it," with a wry, tight-lipped smile. So the Washington Post notes. Chuck Schumer had a good response to it. He said, "It's no surprise. He lives for GOP judges because he knows the GOP agenda is so radical and unpopular, they can only achieve it in courts." That might be a pretty good
characterization of efforts to ban abortion. But it is it's another moment where Mr. McConnell lives up to the title of a biography of him, The Cynic.
Let's take line five from Warren, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Peter, you're on the air.
Hello. Well, I think it goes a lot farther than that. There's a real risk, to my mind, of an authoritarian state really coming about from this, because you have those lower judges coming from the Federalist Society into the Republicans' historic discredit. They are sitting by in the Senate, funneling them through almost like minnows through water. And they are going to be on the, they are young, they are archly nationalistic, and they are going to be on those courts for decades. That's going to influence the law, not just abortion, but a whole galaxy of things for just ages to come. And it's going to make for a very sorry show, in my view. It certainly is making for a very different country, and it's certainly not going to be made great from it either. Okay?
All right. Thank you for your call, Peter. A voice against the president, but also the Senate Majority Leader's activism on this. You know, Julie Mason, it brings to mind the investigative piece not so many days ago in the Washington Post about the role of the Federalist Society, but really the role of Leonard Leo, its executive vice president, in working with a bunch of not-for-profits in concert, but not necessarily overtly in concert or visibly in concert, to try to bring about pressure campaigns to get conservative judges, conservative justices. You know, to be fair, Jack referred to the excellent biography of or political biography of Mitch McConnell by the reporter Alec McGillis about him, called The Cynic. Is this not just politics? Why is this different from the way in which power is exercised in the chambers of Congress over the years?
They're all so hypocritical, and we still retain the power to be shocked by it, which I think is reassuring about humanity generally, if not politicians specifically. But I would say, you know, Barack Obama liked to say all the time that elections have consequences. And okay, Republicans have the majority in the Senate, and actually, when it comes to gamesmanship and things of that nature, they're just better at it. So if you don't like what you see, then vote, as Obama would say as well. We get so focused on these Supreme Court fights, like Brett Kavanaugh, to a certain degree Gorsuch, and of course the ghost of Merrick Garland still haunting the halls of Congress. But as the caller pointed out, these federal judges that are lifetime appointments are just as important.
Can we just talk for one moment about Merrick Garland? Just a moment, Julie.
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
It is striking. You have a guy who was nominated in Obama's last year, seen as something of a moderate, not one of the younger appointments, seen as something of a concession to Republicans to say, we're not going to do this forever, have this guy on forever. And at the same time, you know, you had Republicans declining to even consider this in any way. When we say, look, they're all hypocritical, was this of a different order, or is there a way in which this is just the world we live in, and there truly is an equivalence in both sides?
There's not an equivalence in both sides, because, as I said, I truly believe that Republicans are just better at it. And you even see it now with the White House defiance on subpoenas and cooperating with the investigation. But, I mean, you look at the state of Virginia, for example, and the leadership there, the governor, the lieutenant governor, faced with different allegations. They just stared it down. There was defiance,
too. The state
too.
AG, like, too.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all Democrats.
I mean, right. It comes back to vote. If you don't like what you're seeing, you got to vote. You got to get informed and vote. And that's how things change.
Let's turn now to a severe sweep of weather across the United States, hitting state after state, particularly in the center of the country. We have a clip here of a farmer from Ohio. His name is Kyle McLean, describing his close encounter with a tornado earlier this week. He spoke to NBC4 in Columbus.
I looked up behind the house, and sure enough, there's a tornado come right down the field, and I mean, it dead centered my house. Within, I grabbed my wife and baby, and we dove underneath the stairs, and I told her, I said, start praying to the good God we worship. I said, that's the only thing going to get us through here. And my house literally fell down around me and my wife and 10-month-old baby.
Jessica Rosegard, talk to me about the effects of these storms on the center of the country and what we've seen.
Yeah, it's really been quite astonishing, the number of tornadoes that we've seen recently, and certainly in the center of the country, which is more accustomed to them. But even we've been getting tornado warnings here in Louisiana, which we sometimes do. And New York had a tornado warning this week, which is...
I saw it on my phone.
Yeah, I was concerned for friends. It's bizarre. The tornadoes and then the rainstorms, all of the flooding is really having an impact in the Midwest on farmers that can't even get into the field to plant their crops, which is only going to exacerbate the other financial worries that they have given this trade war. The flooding in the Midwest, of course, eventually funnels into the Mississippi River and eventually comes down our way here in Louisiana. We get the benefits of the river. We have an amazing port here that provides jobs and economic opportunities. We also have the downside, and the river here has been at or near flood stage for a while now. The Army Corps, the Army Corps operates river controls and such up in the Midwest, also down here. So they've had to make some concessions in releasing pressure on the river to protect specifically New Orleans and Baton Rouge. And that's about to have a really big impact here on our farmers.
And you were telling me earlier, it's the spill. What is it called?
Yeah, so we have two spillways along the river. So basically they get open. They're these bays. They pull up a plank of wood, essentially, to open up these bays and release water when the river gets to a certain height or a certain speed, because both of those things threaten levees that protect the city. So releasing that water lessens the pressure on the river. The one that's been opened to protect New Orleans dumps into Lake Pontchartrain, which eventually flows into the Gulf. That's having impacts along the Gulf Coast in Mississippi.
And the lake is, maybe a quarter mile from where we're sitting right at this moment.
Yes, if that, yeah. you don't really see big changes from this diversion in the level of the lake, but that water continues on to the Gulf, and I've been reading that it's really having impacts on aquatic wildlife and fisheries and stuff across the Mississippi coast. We're set to open another spillway next week. That's the one with the more severe impact. It diverts water to protect Baton Rouge through this spillway, through this river plain. But there's 25,000 acres of farmland in the way. So those farmers have been bracing to prepare their fields or abandon their fields, really. And that's kind of unprecedented. The last time that spillway was opened was in 2011. Before that, it hadn't been since 1973. So, that we have to do this, and that all of this water that's impacting the Midwest eventually makes its way down and impacts us here.
So the downriver effect's actually quite severe.
Yes.
I want to take a brief moment to offer a programming note to cover President Trump's visit to the UK next week. On Point, we'll be co-hosting an hour with the BBC Radio 5 live next Tuesday. My colleague Meghna Chakrabarty and the BBC's Nihal Arthanaika will bring you the latest on Brexit and the British Prime Minister Theresa May's forced exit from office. And I wanted to ask you, Julie Mason, what are we to expect from President Trump's visit there? He obviously has been kind of disparaging of her inability to get Brexit through and pumping up some of her internal rivals.
Yeah, they're going to have a joint presser, the two of them, at Downing Street during his visit there. That'll be really interesting to see. It'll be just before she steps away. 3 days later, she's out of a job. So, he's been nice about her so far, but who knows? Once he gets over there, he could say anything. We also expect huge protests. Mostly it's a ceremonial visit, but that's fraught for the president, too. Sometimes he can be a little off message non-diplomatic, if you will. And I can't wait for his meetings with Prince Harry and Prince Charles. That will be epic.
And Jack, very briefly, do you think he's going to openly embrace a guy like Nigel Farage of the Brexit Party, or is he going to try to keep a little bit of a distance?
Well, he campaigned with Farage in 2016, So perhaps. But just looking at the hair, I think Boris Johnson would be a more likely candidate for his endorsement.
And on that serious note, the words and wisdom of Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you.
We're also been joined by Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on SiriusXM's POTUS channel. Thanks, Julie.
You're the best, Dave.
Thank you, Jules. And Jules, Jessica Rusgaard is here. She's supervising editor and producer for WWNO, the NPR member station in New Orleans. Thank you so much for having us in your studios.
Thanks for being here.
And again, special thanks today for everyone at NPR member station WWNO, especially those who have helped with our broadcast today, Ron Biava, Robert Carroll, Paul Mawson, Hallie Sheck, and Thomas Walsh. And new this week, you can find us on Instagram at OnPointNPR. Follow our account for the sights and sounds of our trip to New Orleans and insights behind the scenes. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer a cute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.